Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The bakery and pizzeria Arizmendi serves up gourmet pizzas, breads, and pastries. Rainbow Grocery and other avenues in San Francisco offer an array of organic produce and bulk foods. DIG designs and constructs water catchment systems. The common thread among these companies is that they are all Bay Area worker co-ops. The workers own the company, they share the profits, and the decision-making. The Bay Area is a hub for worker co-ops in the U.S. It's home to about 40 to 50 co-ops, according to the Democracy Institute at Work's annual census count. But New York City is about to surpass the Bay Area since taking bold steps to foster the development of more co-ops. In 2015, New York invested $1.2 million in worker co-ops as an economic model targeting low-income communities and people of color. And the results have been incredible. 21 new co-ops have been created, doubling the number of worker co-ops in New York, and the city is expected to invest another $2.1 million this year. And then in California, Oakland is exploring ways it can cultivate more co-ops. So what kind of alternative economy is this creating for cities and for workers? Joining me today to discuss this are two guests. Melissa Hoover is executive director of the Democracy at Work Institute, an organization that expands worker ownership as a tool to address economic inequality. Before that, Melissa served as the first ED of the U.S. Federation of Worker Co-ops, and she has helped set up new Arizmendi bakery cooperatives. And Melissa joins me in studio. Hi, Melissa. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks.
Great to have you. And we are also joined by Nayeli Maxson. She is policy analyst and community liaison in the office of Oakland Councilmember Annie Campbell Washington. Councilmember Washington drafted a resolution in support of worker co-ops, and Nayeli also joins me in studio. Hi, Nayeli. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. So let's start off by just talking about the very basics. Maybe some people go to Rainbow and they don't know it's a worker co-op, or maybe some people have a handful of their favorite worker co-ops. Let's talk about what worker co-ops actually do and what it means. So worker co-ops are typically governed by employees, and the decision-making process is democratic.
Right, yeah, and I think the most important thing to understand about worker co-ops is that they're small businesses. They're values-driven small businesses, but in many ways they function just like other businesses in the market. I think that there can be a misconception that worker co-ops are nonprofits or some other sort of exotic form, but really they're small businesses owned by a group of people who share the risk and the reward of owning that business. And they operate according to a set of principles and values that center around member benefit and community benefit. So they do business in a slightly different way.
And there's a difference between worker co-ops and co-ops, right? Because sometimes REI often bills themselves as a co-op, but REI is not worker-owned.
That's right. REI is a consumer co-op. So the cooperative form is an old one in our country and internationally, and it's simply a member-based form. And the kind of co-op is determined by who the members are. So in REI or food co-ops, the members are the people who are buying from the co-op. And in a worker co-op, the members are the people who are working in the co-op.
Okay, so let's give us some more information about a worker co-op, Nayeli. What would you add to that?
I think one of the critical pieces that we're looking at in Oakland is the transformative nature of the worker cooperative system. Looking at the local economy and the neighborhood business districts, this is a huge opportunity for us to empower our residents and help them to take a lead role in making these business districts into very vibrant pieces of our neighborhoods.
And can you give me clear-cut examples? Because I understand that co-ops are becoming so popular that small business owners are selling their business to the employees, which then turn it into a co-op.
Yeah, some are referring to this as the silver tsunami, which I think is very catchy. But it's an opportunity for us to see some would say in the Bay Area, there are 100,000 baby boomers who are going to be retiring in coming years. And only about 15% of the businesses that are being passed along right now are going to the next generation family members. And then after that, even a smaller percentage goes to third generation family members. So really, we're looking at 85% of businesses that are changing ownership hands. It's a huge opportunity for us to take this model and say, hey, is this something you've considered? this is something that, you know, you wouldn't have to fire any of your employees. You would actually be empowering them and take some of the folks who have been here for so long and give them the opportunity to take a leadership role in their community.
Melissa, can you give us an example of a business that has recently transformed into a co-op?
Sure. I'm going to go with one from New York City, because I think it's really interesting illustration. There's a passive solar construction company in New York City with about 15 worker owners called Build with Prospect. And it was started by a guy who's an architect and created a building company. And about 5-10 years into owning the company, he realized there was a disincentive for training his workers into this very specialized job because they might just leave, other companies might poach them. And he thought, you know, it weakened his company to have to not, you know, to sort of take that into consideration. So as he was exploring his next stage in life, he's a young guy, he's an entrepreneur, he wants to move on and do something else. He thought, well, if I actually share ownership with the workers in the company, there'll be a reason and a real incentive to train them deeply into the field, and then they'll stay. That money and that training won't walk out the door when they go on to their next job. So it was a way to stabilize the workforce, bring them into ownership, and for him to leave and go on and do his next thing. I think he's going to move to the country and start another business. So that's Build with Prospect, and we hear that a lot. It's a really typical story. Either a serial entrepreneur or a retiring owner mm-hmm. can't find a buyer for the business who will honor the values and principles of the owner. And so they want to institutionalize those values and principles. And the best way to do that is to take the workforce that's already there and, share ownership with them so that they become the group owners of the business.
It's interesting to look at what's happening in New York. New York has taken a very bold step in supporting the development of co-ops, and they're using this as a strategy in economic development, specifically targeting low-income communities and communities of color. So last year, New York invested $1.2 million, and the results have been amazing. Next City has an incredible article. We have it up at yourcallradio.org. The number of co-ops has doubled in the last year. And so in New York, there are now 21 new worker co-ops. Melissa, what do you think about this strategy of the government getting involved?
I think it's incredible. A word of caveat, you know, those new worker co-ops are pretty fledgling. They're small businesses. They're vulnerable in their early years. And so 21 new worker co-ops in New York isn't quite the same as the sort of 40 plus 10-year-old, more than 10 years old worker co-ops here in the Bay Area. So it's a new ecosystem. So I think we need to be cautious about understanding that and supporting it and really making sure that those businesses can stay and grow. But I think the really critical thing to understand about New York is this is the wave of the future. These entrepreneurs are the next entrepreneurs. And they're in many cases finding entrepreneurship because they're locked out of other opportunities. And so they have to create their own jobs. They may be contingent workers in the gig economy, contractors, or they may be people who want to start a small business, but don't have the capital or resources all on their own. So they're pooling those resources and that knowledge to come together and start their own thing. New York City sees that, you know, wave of immigrant business owners, returning citizen business owners, new Americans who are starting businesses because they're making their own opportunities. And I think that, you know, they really want to encourage that and support it.
And the 21 newly created worker co-ops in New York are distributed across 11 industries, manufacturing, education, a yoga studio. So it's very diverse. And Melissa, can you talk about what happens when a city government, for example, gets involved?
Well, I think, you know, most clearly the city government in New York City has provided funding for co-op members and co-op developers to create these new businesses and help them grow, help them access capital. But there are, I think, some other more subtle ways that the city is involved that in the long run are going to be even more powerful than immediate funding. And that is they're institutionalizing support for the cooperative business form in their small business services, which is a big part of the New York City business support ecosystem. Small Business Services helps all kinds of entrepreneurs start and grow businesses. And then secondly, I think it's incredible that New York City has committed to measure purchasing from worker co-ops. So the city itself is one of the largest drivers of the economy in New York, and they're going to start measuring what they buy from worker co-ops, which is a step towards prioritizing purchasing from worker co-ops because they share the values and support what cooperatives are trying to do in the economy.
Are there any drawbacks to getting involved with city government?
You know, city government, depending on sort of the size and nature of the bureaucracy, it can move slowly. You can be subject to some political whims. So I think understanding that city government can be a catalyst and a supporter, but isn't the end. There's got to be other actors supporting the growth of a cooperative economy and an ecosystem.
And you helped set up new Arizmendi bakeries. Did Arizmendi work with city governments at all?
Yeah, Arizmendi has worked with the city government. I can't speak to all of the bakeries, but I know that, for instance, the city of Emeryville, when the Arizmendi on San Pablo was going in, provided some tax incentives, maybe a rent abatement for the space because it was a redevelopment area and they wanted an anchor business. And the Arizmendi on Lakeshore had been shown to be a key tenant in revitalizing that neighborhood, you know, which became a really vibrant small business district. So that's a really great example of the way that a city can commit just a very small amount of funding or even you know, other kinds of support, and co-op can then take that and run with it.
And Nayeli, in Oakland, Councilmember Annie Campbell Washington introduced a resolution in support of worker co-ops, and Councilmember Lynette McElhaney said worker co-ops could also be a workforce development strategy for people who are formerly incarcerated, saying that giving people the dignity of ownership in addition to having work is another reason to back this. So what would this resolution do exactly?
Absolutely. So when community members first came forward and approached the council member on this issue, she looked at this as, you know, what can we do right away? What can we move on right away? Because as Melissa mentioned, government does move rather slow. And what she saw is this is an opportunity for us to right away say, hey, the city of Oakland is very welcoming and supportive of every kind of worker cooperative who wants to open its doors in the city. Please come here. Know that we support you. And, you know, we will work in the meantime on building up a larger ordinance that provides many different supportive policies. So that's what we're working on now. We have sent our stuff forward to the city attorney's office, and the council member is expecting to co-sponsor a piece of legislation in the next month or two with council member Dan Kolb. So what we're looking at in that piece of legislation is a very comprehensive piece. So something Melissa mentioned in New York is measuring the number of contracts that are given to worker cooperatives. What we're looking at doing in Oakland is not just measuring that, but actually providing some preferential treatment to those businesses over businesses that are not worker cooperatives. The city already does this with small businesses and locally owned and, you know, minority owned businesses. But we're looking at taking this as an opportunity to provide one more measurement, one more tool to support the growth of this type of business within the city of Oakland. So we're looking at that. We're looking at ways that we can provide support to these nonprofit organizations that are incredible in fostering this growth. So a couple examples are the Sustainable Economies Law Center, Project Equity. The organization that Melissa works with is another very strong local organization that helps to grow this economy. And so this piece of legislation, we're still in development now, but we're feeling very excited about bringing that forward in just a short amount of time.
That is Nayeli Maxson. She is policy analyst and community liaison in the office of Oakland Councilmember Annie Campbell Washington. Councilmember Washington drafted a resolution in support of worker co-ops. Melissa Hoover is executive director of the Democracy at Work Institute, an organization that expands worker ownership as a tool to address income inequality. Annie, before that, she worked as the first executive director of the Federation of Worker Co-ops, and Melissa also has set up new Arizmendi bakery cooperatives. And today we are talking about the power of worker co-ops. They are expanding, and in many ways they're expanding because they're getting help from the city. New York City invested $1.2 million last year, and as a result, New York has seen the setup of 21 new co-ops, doubling the number of co-ops before that. New York is expected to invest another $2 million this year. So what questions do you have about worker co-ops? If you're part of a worker co-op, we'd love to hear from you. What has been your experience? What are the benefits? What are the challenges? And if you have a favorite co-op, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we already have a few callers on the line. So let's go to Esteban Kelly calling in from Philadelphia. He is co-executive director of the U.S. Federation of Worker Co-ops. Hi, Esteban. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Thank you for calling in. So I understand you have been in meetings all day, or yesterday in meetings in New York with worker co-ops.
Meeting at the Ford Foundation where we were talking about the future of work in this country and around the world. It was organized by the Institute for the Future, which is headquartered in the Bay Area. And then we also had a membership meeting, an annual meeting and elections for our members on the ground in New York City. They have what I think from the outside could be understood as almost like a chapter of the U.S. Federation of Worker Co-ops. And so all those members on the ground that Melissa was just speaking about, some of them are newly developed co-ops, and some of them have been established for a while. They gather at least once a year to get together and do their own governance and elections and planning. So I was there for that meeting last night in New York.
And so talk a little bit about how this is affecting workers. Bill Moyers had an article last year just about how worker co-ops are bringing people out of poverty. And one woman, Yadira Fragasso, is quoted. And after she became a worker owner at CC Puede, a cleaning co-op in Brooklyn, her wages went from $6.25 an hour to $25 an hour. I mean, that is a major, major increase.
Yeah, the quality of jobs are just absolutely staggering. Some of it is in fact in wages and salaries, but I think it's can be overly reductive to just sort of look at that one dimension of a job. The idea of ownership is really important, and the reality of being able to own a piece of a business and have an asset that enters into your whole calculation of your family wealth or your community wealth can't be overstated. And then there's also other kinds of benefits. Those could be health benefits, retirement benefits. It really depends on the business itself, the industry that you're in, and the opportunities for that. But certainly competitive wages are one very important piece of it, and the opportunity for lifting people out of poverty or creating opportunities to be upwardly mobile in their own work life and careers. And that's part of what's driving what the earlier guests were saying about the growth that we're seeing right now, this incredible swell, even in the last 5 years, 10 years, certainly in the last 15 years, through both conversions of existing traditional businesses that are selling to the employees, but also startups, people who have an idea, and rather than going the sole proprietor or joint ownership option with one other person and bearing all that risk or bearing that risk as a family and sinking all of your family assets into it and hoping that it works out, people are really choosing as startup businesses to establish worker co-ops instead.
Can you also talk about what workers have told you just in terms of how it affects their dignity? Because, you know, I'm looking at all of these photos of mostly women of color who are working at these co-ops in New York, and it reminds me of a lot of women that I've interviewed over the years who work at Walmart who say, I just feel like there's no dignity. Not only do you get paid horrible wages, but you're never told you're just doing a good job. And, you know, some of the women said, if anything, for me, that's what's most important, to be acknowledged.
Well, it goes much deeper than being acknowledged, because when we talk about workplace democracy, this is this concept where it's not just that you have a say, but you actually have control over what happens. And so your perspective as a worker, your technical expertise in whatever industry you're doing, whether you're cleaning homes or driving a cab or baking bread, all of those things matter. And so it's not just a matter of appealing to a manager or an owner or a boss or a supervisor, but actually being able to chime in with your perspective and have that influence brought to bear on your marketing, your business planning, and everyday operational decisions of the business.
Right.
So it's different than just sort of saying, hey, your voice matters here. That dignity really shines through, that people, that idea that actions speak louder than words. When you're part of a democratic process in the everyday operations of a business, people really feel that in their everyday life. And then that influences how they exist elsewhere in the world, not just how they show up in the job, but we've seen these women take a more active role in the school system and other kinds of public institutions when they're advocating for their children, in their neighborhoods and neighborhood associations, and in other dimensions of their lives. So it really does end up being a boost for everything involved in their engagement in their community.
Well, thank you for calling in, Esteban. That's Esteban Kelly. He is co-executive director with the U.S. Federation of Worker Co-ops. We have time for one more call before we go to break. Let's go to Robert in Richmond. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Well, I've been a longtime resident of Berkeley, and now I live in Richmond. But I also was a longtime customer at the Cheese Board on Shattuck, which is now opened about 10 years ago, I guess. An amazingly successful pizza restaurant as well. And I just wondered, I thought that the Cheese Board actually was the seed company that started Arizmendi a long time ago. And they went through a process, I think, of actually putting out a manual for other companies to how to, you know, start at least a bakery cooperative, I think. Am I right there? Is Arizmendi an outgrowth of the Cheese Board in Berkeley?
Yeah, Arizmendi is, in fact, an outgrowth of the Cheese Board. The Cheese Board helped contribute capital, their recipes, their processes and ways of doing things to help the Arizmendi Association get started. And the Cheese Board is, to this day, a member of that association. So they are, in many ways, the mothership of the Arizmendi Association. One of their members was a member of a study group that resulted in the creation of Arizmendi. And I think it's a really critical point as we look at how startups grow around the country. They often, they don't come out of thin air necessarily, right? They come out of existing institutions and spin-offs and what people already know how to do and the resources that they're already connected to. So as we look at how co-ops grow, particularly this new wave of worker co-ops in service industry and home care and cleaning, the same thing is happening, not quite as directly as the Cheese Board Arizmendi connection, but existing co-ops are helping new co-ops get started in all kinds of ways, and that's that happens in conventional business as well. I just think it's important to acknowledge the role of the wave of co-ops that were started in the 70s and the 90s in the current growth.
Nayeli, did
you have...
anything to add there?
Yeah. So Melissa and her organization hosted this incredible conference on what creates that fertile ecosystem where what you're describing as not coming from thin air is able to occur in a more organic and more common occurrence in our city. And so the council member, Campbell Washington, and I both attended that conference. And what we saw there was there is absolutely a method to creating this fertile ground. And part of what was key in that event and making that event so successful, from my opinion, was the fact that you had included not just the worker cooperative folks, but you also included, I know, Aaron Kilmer-Neal from Oakland Grown, another local business supporting organization who sees small local businesses as being crucial to the growth of our city's neighborhoods. You know, she was also in attendance. So I think looking at this as a very broad coalition where we need to engage all of the organizations who are playing a role in this field is really a huge key to the success of this.
A report on co-ops by the Federation of Protestant Welfare Agencies in New York says there is no greater medicine for apathy and feelings of living on the edges of society than to see your own work and your voice make a difference. Mm-hmm. I think that says a lot about co-ops. Today on Your Call, we are talking about the power of co-ops, what they are, and what happens when city governments get involved. In the case of New York City, which invested, well, actually last year it created a $1.2 million co-op development initiative. 21 new co-ops were created, doubling the number of worker co-ops in New York. Here in California, Oakland is exploring ways it can cultivate more co-ops. And if you have questions or questions or comments about co-ops, or if you've worked at a co-op, if you have a favorite co-op, we would love to hear from you. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Is better when you get involved. If you have a question or idea or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss ways to preserve arts and culture in the Bay Area. In a recent survey, artists in San Francisco and Oakland said that the cost of housing and studio space make it difficult to be an artist. It's an all too familiar story. We have been here many times. The artists who are creating a dynamic culture are being priced out. So what should cities do to protect the arts? It's almost related to what we're talking about today, just trying to ensure that people can make ends meet and stay in the places like San Francisco and Oakland, for example, and not be priced out. Today, we are talking about worker co-ops and the power of worker co-ops. The Bay Area is home to between 40 and 50, but New York is about to surpass us because the city is investing $2.1 million this year to help co-ops. And we're joined today by Melissa Hoover, Executive Director of the Democracy at Work Institute, an organization that expands worker ownership as a tool to address economic inequality. Melissa has helped set up new Arizmendi bakery co-ops. Nayeli Maxson is policy analyst and community liaison in the office of Oakland Councilmember Annie Campbell Washington. Councilmember Washington drafted a resolution in support of worker co-ops. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Now I would like to welcome Lauren Rogers to the show. Lauren is Executive Director of the National Center for Employee Ownership. He has been working in employee ownership since 1995, and he joins us from Oakland. Hi, Lauren. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's nice to have you. So we've been talking about, you know, what is a worker co-op? How does it affect employees? Owners of small businesses are currently selling their businesses to employees that are then transforming those businesses into worker co-ops. What changes are you seeing in the Bay Area?
Well, a lot of what we're seeing is due to the great work that Melissa and her colleagues are doing, and I think what we see in New York is a great way to see what Commerce Councilmember Campbell Washington might be able to push through here in my hometown, Oakland. So we're pretty excited about all that. A lot of what we do at the National Center for Employee Ownership is relevant based on how wide you want to draw the circle around employee ownership, whether you would include companies that are employee-owned not through worker co-ops but through other forms as well.
And can you talk about how this affects the economy at a time when we're seeing such a huge concentration of wealth? Forbes actually had a really interesting article called "If Apple Were a Worker Co-op, Each Employee Would Earn at Least $403,000." Apple has 98,000 employees, earned almost $40 billion after tax over the past year. And so even the lowest paid worker at Apple would have earned about $403,000 if it were a co-op.
Yeah, I thought that was a wonderful article.
Yeah.
And I thought another sort of type of company that might be even more interesting to look at in the way that article approached it would be the gig economy companies, because there are ways that lots of people have a little portion of their income channeled into a very small company. And if those companies were worker-owned, I think that would have a pretty profound effect on those workers and on how people across the country see the gig economy.
Hmm. We have an email from Delmore in Oakland. There was news earlier this month that the Yellow Cab Co-op, San Francisco's largest taxi company, is declaring bankruptcy. How did that co-op work? Do you know, Lauren? Have you been following this?
They work. They work like other cab companies. So I'm not familiar with the bankruptcy in particular, but I know Melissa is also familiar with some of the worker co-op cab companies in other cities, which might be a good model for Yellow Cab to move toward.
Yeah, I'm more familiar with the sort of straightforward worker co-op cab companies. There is another model for cooperative cab companies, which is the Yellow Cab San Francisco model. I think it's a fairly light-touch cooperative where the drivers buy in or in some way own the company but aren't employed by it. So we call that a producer co-op, typically, where there are a bunch of independent contractors who come together to market their services or to buy equipment together. So my hunch is that that's what Yellow Cab Co-op was, and the other sort of the other more traditional older school cab companies have been. What we're seeing now is a huge wave of startups of worker-owned cab companies that are forming, in large part, I think, in response to the disruptions in the cab industry by other kinds of car services, and the principles and values of a worker co-op are a direct counter to the extractive model of sort of the drivers bearing all the externalities of the company, which is to say paying for their own gas, paying for their own insurance, bearing all of the risk and getting very little of the return for their labor. The worker co-op is often formed by the very same people who may be driving for those companies, and wanting something a little bit more long-term that they actually own and control. So, the country's oldest co-op cab company is in Madison, Wisconsin. It's about 200 drivers. The company covers workers, pays a wage, it covers workers' comp. Those workers are protected. There's a whole process around accidents and insurance that keeps the risk and the return within the company, but it allows the drivers to have some control over that rather than extracting out profits from the driver's labor. And I think, those drivers are happier, they're more secure, they're longer term. And the Union Cab Co-op of Madison is one of the co-ops that's animating sort of the second wave of city interest in co-ops, if I may speak to that a little bit. The mayor of Madison, in part in direct response to seeing how Union Cab Co-op drivers thrive and how it is a community institution, said, we need to support more worker co-ops here. So not to be outdone by the mayor of New York, committed $5 million over 5 years to the growth of worker co-ops in Madison. And Union Cab was leading the charge on that.
And also, for people who maybe don't know what's happening with Yellow Cab, according to reports, the cab companies are really hurting because of Uber and Lyft. I mean, cab drivers have told me that their take-home wages have been cut in half. Mm-hmm. But this Yellow Cab specifically, part of the problem stems from lawsuits that they're dealing with, mm-hmm. where they have million-dollar payouts. They're saying that that's more of the problem than the Uber and Lyft competition. So thank you for that email. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Today we are talking about worker-owned co-ops. If you work for one, we'd love to hear from you. What has your experience been like? If you have a favorite, we'd love to hear from you. Why do you shop at co-ops? Do you go out of your way to support co-ops? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Glenn couldn't stay on the line. He wanted to know, how does it work for the worker owners? What happens if you want to leave? We have a related email from Diane who says, back in the 70s, I was in book distribution at a co-op in New Orleans. There were five of us. At some point over our first year, each one of us had to work out our conflicts with each other. We stuck it out. And when the process was finished, we were amazed. I used to feel like I had one finger on a hand. She says she's using voice recognition, so I have to kind of decipher this email. That experience has stayed with me for the rest of my life, learning how to work closely with people who are of equal value but of different personalities and capacity. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, our economic model wasn't viable, and I reluctantly left, but it has contributed to my work abilities for the rest of my life.
And I would add, you know, just because people leave the worker cooperative model for one period of their life doesn't mean they're not going to come back to that. There's a resident who's been working with a council member on possibly building a grocery store in the segment of District 4 that's in East Oakland, in the Fairfax Business District. She used to work for a worker cooperative in West Oakland, actually left that for various reasons, and years down the line is now looking at this again as something. She has the skills, she knows how to start a business from doing it with her colleagues back in, I think, like the 70s or so, and now she's coming back to those skills. Those skills stay with you for life.
Right.
And it is easy to leave.
Right. Yeah. Okay. No, it's not. You're not in there for life. right. So to speak to that question specifically, the mechanics of owning a business, in a cooperative form, you buy into the business, and then that you own a share in the business, and that share entitles you to a distribution of the profits and some voting rights in the business. And so when you leave, when you terminate your membership, you get your share back, and your voting rights and your rights to the profits also terminate. You may also get a payout of some accumulated surplus that you've reinvested in the business over the years. So, it's a fairly simple, it can be a fairly simple mechanism. It can also be complex. And I think Nayeli makes a great point that what you're also taking with you, in addition to your equity share when you leave, is a suite of skills that make you an incredibly mm-hmm. valuable worker and business owner. Conflict resolution, democratic negotiation, how to run a meeting, how to participate effectively in a meeting, how to give and receive feedback. All of those really sophisticated skills are what worker co-ops invest in, because they make the business stronger and they make the worker owner stronger. And I think that we may fail to recognize those as the kind of really valuable skills that they are, but we don't learn those in school. We don't really typically learn them on the job and other kinds of jobs. And we know that they make worker owners much more valuable within their own workplaces, and then when they leave, they have a much stronger cross-trained set of skills.
Oh, we have a related question about the rapport of worker co-ops. Let's go to Dave in San Francisco. Hi, Dave. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much, and thanks for this topic. I'm Dave in San Francisco, and mine is a question about how it feels each day to work at a co-op. What's the atmosphere of the rapport? How do I have a give and take with my coworkers? How is that atmosphere different at a co-op from that private companies and corporations that I've worked at all my life? Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
I think that's a great question. I mean, I would answer it by saying walk into any worker co-op in the Bay Area. Walk into an Arizmendi Bakery, a Rainbow, and other avenues, an Alvarado Street Bakery, and you'll see happy workers who are, able to fully realize themselves on the job. So that's the happy, self-actualized part of it. I guess I would also say that there's a deeper engagement in the running of the business. So you are bearing the risk, you're taking the responsibility, you're making the decisions together. So I think in a lot of ways it's really transformative for people who not only have never been asked for their opinion about how something works on their job, but they've been actively silenced from offering it, or it hasn't been honored or acknowledged. One of the striking things about some research that's been done on the largest worker co-op in the country, which is a 2,300-person home care cooperative in the Bronx in New York, Cooperative Home Care Associates. Home care is difficult work. It's low paid. It's often not honored as the skilled and important work that it is. And it's often done by women of color and recent immigrants. One of the striking things about the research that was done on that workplace was the deep importance of respect to the workers, that the sense that to a person, they said the most important thing about this job is that I feel respected. Mm. I feel respected by my coworkers, by my supervisors, by my clients. And that's a fundamental human need for respect that I think we don't honor enough in the workplace. And that job is still a hard job. It's still not paid as much as it should be, but the respect makes all the difference there.
Yeah, exactly. And that was one of the co-ops that was profiled in this Bill Moyers piece. It's 90% owned by women of color, and they make about $16 an hour, including benefits. And this is twice what women make who are not in a co-op in this field.
Right, yeah, it's the work is horribly underpaid. And I think in addition to the wages, as Esteban mentioned earlier, in addition to the wages and benefits, we need to think about the sort of evolution of the service workforce, mm-hmm. which is that people are increasingly contingent. They have no control over their schedules. They're underscheduled so that employers don't have to pay benefits. And then you're trying to piece together two part-time jobs for which you're on call all the time. So, you know, in addition to the wage increase and the benefits, I think the scheduling stability and the ability to have full-time employment, I mean, it's amazing to me that we are in a position where we're fighting for people's rights to have just basic full-time employment. So the idea that a co-op can be used to provide that, it's as some of the previous guests have said, it's a mobility strategy for people to build wealth, but it's also at this point in our economy, a stability strategy, a way for people to stabilize jobs, to stabilize their work life, and to participate in a way that brings them greater respect and dignity on the job.
You know, just talking about that, I was thinking about Walmart again, because they're going to close 269 stores, and one of them is in Oakland. Mm-hmm. And this is where the minimum wage is going up. The Chronicle had a piece about this saying that the stores are closing in cities where the minimum wage has recently gone up. And so, Nayeli, there are going to be people mm-hmm. who are needing jobs soon, because this store is going to close soon.
Yes, yes, exactly. And I think that's such an interesting point. I mean, this is a huge opportunity for us to step in with supportive legislation and say, what can we do to foster a more embracing environment for these worker cooperatives? And what can we do soon so that we can step in and provide these structures for people to empower themselves? I mean, really key here is we're not asking some person or entity to come in from outside and save anyone. What we're talking about is providing the funding and the support for local organizations to build skills and to help provide access to capital, and then empower the residents who are losing their jobs at Walmart or what have you to actually create the solutions themselves and gain those skills, like we said earlier, that they're going to have for their entire lives. And like Esteban said, can, of course, translate into greater, civic action and more involvement in District 4, where Councilmember Annie Campbell Washington sits. You know, we would love to see greater voter turnout, more people showing up to the beautiful Oakland Schools projects that she holds. We would love to see that type of engagement translate not just into what you do for your profession, but also what you do in your community.
And are you hearing from more Oakland business owners, small business owners, who are interested in selling the business to employees rather than shut it down?
Yes. So that is a great point. We had a meeting, the council member and I sat down with a couple of folks from Project Equity, and they actually brought to this meeting a list of businesses in Oakland who they would expect, based on the age of the business, would be ripe for this type of a potential conversion. And so the council member is taking a look at that and taking a look at what information we can now require businesses provide so that we can keep track of which businesses are going to be more likely to be retiring, which owners are going to be retiring in the near future, so we can target that, because right now we just don't have that data of which of these are ripe for conversion.
Where can people find more information about this? Jeffrey wrote in and said, you mentioned that a bakery had a written pamphlet on how to do this. Is there any literature that helps people understand how to run a co-op or transfer a small business into a co-op?
Sure. Yeah, well, the first thing I'll mention is our website, becomingeo.org, which is becomingemployeeowned.org. It's for small business owners who are interested in learning about how to transition their business to worker ownership. We've got a bunch of case studies. You can see stories of across a variety of industries, and then there's some tools, and we provide consultations for business owners. We're part of a national collaborative, the Workers to Owners Collaborative, which has partners in cities around the country that support these kind of transitions. So I would suggest for small business owners interested in sharing ownership with their workers to check out becomingeo.org. And then for more general co-op resources and information about city policies, information about structuring and starting co-ops, our website, institute.coop, www.institute.coop, has a treasure trove of resources for both for small business owners and for, you know, everyday citizens and for city officials who are interested in supporting, you know, small business as the backbone of community vitality.
I would also add the Sustainable Economies Law Center. If you go onto their website, they hold free legal clinics where they provide this type of advice to business owners or people looking at starting a business for free.
Okay, thank you. And you can also go to our website, yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Sheila. She says, I shop at co-ops because I want to support worker-owned businesses. I know it's a viable business model because workers who own their workplaces get fair treatment, fair pay, and benefits. We need this now more than ever. She writes, I live in a limited equity co-op in Berkeley and know the values gained from sharing space and facilities and lives, let alone the lower costs of housing we all enjoy in the current madness of the Bay Area real estate market. It makes for more harmony in the world. Thank you for the email, Sheila. And let's hear next from KDF in Oakland. Hi, KDF. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Rose. I was part of one of the first successful worker co-ops in the San Francisco Bay Area. It was the radical feminist newspaper of record, Plexus West Coast Women's Press. And I'm happy to tell you that Reveal Digital is going to be digitizing all 13 years of our monthly newspaper, which was between 24 and 36 pages. And we were the people that the women who were trying to put together the women's building came to in order to be able to raise funds to create the women's building. We put this imaginary women's building drawing on our front page and ran with it.
Oh, wow. That's great.
We have news, reviews, features, calendar. The calendar created the space so that women who were interested in stopping rape and other projects like that could find each other. We were at the center of the entire growth of the radical feminist movement in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And I'm so happy that Reveal Digital is going to be digitizing us, so you can see that I'm not just blowing hot air, and we actually were on the front line of Shirley Chisholm's run and, you know, so many other news stories where we had first-person pyramid journalism. And also, currently, if anybody wants to see what I'm talking about, we're on microfilm in the magazine and newspaper room of the Oakland Public Library main branch, and also in the Hormel collection in the main branch of the San Francisco Public Library and Civic Center.
Well, KDF, thank you so much for calling in. We'd like to get your contact info, so if you can stay on the line, that's a great story. I'd love to check out some of those archives. We have just a couple minutes left, but I'd like you to talk a little bit more about the benefits, because I've been thinking a little bit about Other Avenues, which is a worker-owned co-op out by the beach, and they sell produce. It's a smallish grocery store, but they have almost everything you need. And they recently put solar panels on their rooftop, and so the whole store is now run by solar. And every time I go in there, and it's quite often, I always see a new local business that is highlighted. And it really does kind of feel like a community because it's small enough. So can you talk about some of the other benefits that we haven't mentioned yet?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so we've been talking a lot about the benefits to workers of worker co-ops, which makes sense. But I think it's really critical to understand the broader benefits. So worker co-ops often provide services that are unavailable through other outlets. They may meet community need. They may have a deeper commitment to meeting community needs. They do business differently, so they're owned by the people who live in the neighborhood. They're not going to pollute. They're not going to extract from the from their local area. They're going to give back. And, you know, we know that small business anchors wealth. It anchors jobs. It creates these vital public corridors. It doesn't leave. And worker co-ops are sort of like small business on steroids. They're more owners. They're more anchored. And they're more committed to community benefits. So as we look at cities dealing with the effects of inequality, dealing with Walmart closing, but to be honest, dealing with Walmart existing there in the first place, with wealth concentrating, poverty concentrating by race and by neighborhood, I think it's critically important that we look at the ownership of small business as one of the ways that cities are going to deal with the problems that are falling squarely in their backyards. So as cities come to encourage more worker ownership, I think we'll see broader prosperity, we'll see stronger small businesses, and we'll see small businesses that are more strongly connected to their local communities in all kinds of ways, from solar panels to higher wages, to giving donations, to employing youth in summer internship programs. There are a million multiplier effects.
I think it's very interesting that wages circulate locally, but the advantage of worker ownership is then profits also circulate locally instead of going to Wall Street or some distant owner. I thought it'd be interesting to talk about some of the data, because I absolutely agree, one of the most disruptive things that can happen to a community is losing a major employer. And there's really nice data on worker ownership in general, not specific to worker cooperatives, but about worker ownership, that people who work for worker-owned businesses end up with about 2.5 times as much wealth as people who work for non-employee-owned businesses. And they, in the last recession, people who were worker owners were laid off at about one quarter of the rate of non-employee owners.
Hmm.
There are also some great stories talking about Walmart. Two companies that are often considered the Walmart killers, the ones who compete with Walmart successfully, are Winco and Public Supermarket, both of which are employee-owned. And there's a great story that Forbes had in a blog post about two twins who applied to Winco on the same day. They had an anti-nepotism policy, so they only hired one. That person's now has almost $1 million in her ownership account, and the other person is unfortunately struggling to be able to retire.
Wow. Just quickly, Nayeli, final thoughts from you, 30 seconds?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the biggest takeaway here is that local governments have a huge amount to gain by investing in this solution. When we see the impacts of this happening in places like Madison and New York, we get the message loud and clear, and the council member is charging ahead.
Nayeli Maxson is policy analyst and community liaison in the office of Oakland Councilmember Annie Campbell Washington. Melissa Hoover is ED of the Democracy at Work Institute, and Lauren Rogers is the ED of the National Center for Employee Ownership. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss ways to preserve arts and culture in the Bay Area. In a recent survey, artists in San Francisco and Oakland said that the cost of housing and studio space make it difficult to be an artist. It's an all-too-familiar story. The artists who are creating a dynamic culture are being priced out. So what should cities do to protect the arts? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.